Jim resents it very definitely. Mm-hmm. And he even, in one case, uses the phrase, nothing but a metaphysics. Trying to get back, I guess, as the others. But there is that, that something that it looks upon everything as though it was a phenomenon. And I had sympathy with James's crustacean, I remember.
I am myself and myself alone.
Yes, I am myself and myself alone. Yeah. No such thing. I'm myself and myself alone.
And the crustacean was subjecting to being called a crustacean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, the crustacean said, objected to being classified as a crustacean. He says, I'm myself and myself alone. Well, that's when I felt that way in dealing with a psychologist.
A friend of mine who was always asking his psychology friends, how am I?
Well, now, Jung has made Freud here quite vulnerable, if you ever come up into trouble with a Freud here. Because there's a story about Freud in there that shows that he wasn't too well himself psychologically. Are you familiar with this?
No, I didn't find it. Very curious about it from what you said.
Well, it's Jung reveals the man there, whereas other works are the works of a scientist. Mm-hmm. And to give you a better understanding of what it's all about, yes, a man is well worth knowing. As an immensely worth
knowing. Raymond, what did Jung mean by introvert?
Introvert?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a movement of your interest toward the subject of consciousness.
Is that the same thing as inversion of consciousness?
No.
Well, that's what they were trying to... That's what they meant. That's what Dorothy was asking a while ago, really.
That's coming out of the cave.
Mm-hmm.
And back into it, isn't it?
You see, ordinarily, people are born with an attitude over which they don't have much control. Namely, more or less introverted or more or less extroverted. But in yoga, there must be a conscious movement within, which is equivalent to conscious introversion, which actually is carried far deeper than is ordinarily the case. Now, the ordinary prejudice of the extrovert is that the introvert is engaged with his beloved ego, that it has a narcissistic effect. But you're going in yogic introversion far deeper than that, introverting to the self. To that which is a subject and never an object, whereas the ego can be handled as a sort of subtle object. It's very different. And in other words, too, it involves turning the word into a verb. In other words, you introvert a deliberate act, and which involves the power to extrovert at will, and that's the thing to do. Most people can't do that. They're committed by their own psychology.
Wouldn't that then be synonymous with turning the light of consciousness turning upon itself?
Toward its source, right.
Toward its source.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now,
well, if you introvert far enough, wouldn't you come to the inversion of consciousness then?
Yes, the inversion of consciousness is an autonomous process, as I experienced. Your introversion is conscious and deliberate, but your inversion of consciousness is something that just happens. and I can give them a description or two of one form of it very easily. And I say you have, through self-analysis, stripped down, or just stripped off your identification with any everything whatsoever that can be an object, which is your body and your feelings, your senses. It's a little more difficult to break the identification with thinking, but can be done. And till you finally arrive at something which is never an object under any circumstances, and that is the pure self. And the only thing you can do is to sink back into it and not place it before you as an object at all. So that I found was the opening door into a tremendous state of consciousness. Involving an ascension and also a point of discontinuity where there was a momentary blackout and then in consciousness, where there was an inversion of the meaning of the self. The self in the first case became a point, as it were, surrounded by an environment. I and everything, the world about me, with the body here and all the various functions being part of that world about. And here the self became an all-inclusive sphere in which the whole world, all that was, the whole universe, was contained. An inversion of its meaning from a point to an all-inclusive sphere. You can't, apparently you couldn't hold the two concepts together, so there was a point of discontinuity when there was a blackout and a shift to the other side. I tried to hold that point conscious all the way, I couldn't do it. I wanted to hold that blackout and shift over to the other side. Very fast, but there was inversion. Then you have the other inversion in the mind, where from the point where you view consciousness as a function of a self, to the point where you view the self as a function of consciousness and also the object as a function of consciousness. That's radical inversion. That's what you mean by inversion.
Well, that's the completes the dialectic then. Yeah. That completes the dialectic.
Yeah. Well, that's very different from introversion. Young, you are familiar with Aurobindo?
Not very much, no.
He's very good. I gave him 10 years. He uses the same term, quite independent of the inversion of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Very curious. His Life Divine is a rich philosophical book. But he says he didn't write it, his pen wrote. He himself is a poet. And he said that in some of his letters, they tell me it's good philosophy. And he tells on himself that he once, when he was at Cambridge, opened the pages of some philosophic book, and he said that he turned away from it with complete non-understanding. And here he wrote magnificent philosophy. But it's what he would call a yogic demonstration. And by a yogic demonstration, it is meant that you do very skillfully something that you didn't know anything about. So he didn't know anything about philosophy, and he wrote a magnificent work on philosophy. The greatest master I know of the German sentence in the English language.
Well,
I would recommend him. He's really a treat.
I have read some of his essays on the key.
But that's good. That's good. I recommend The Life Divine.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, I don't always agree with it. I don't get in positions. not my business to repeat anybody else. Mm. But I do overlap many. It's very difficult. One lets yourself get caught by somebody else for repeating an evil thing. It's your duty, however, to be yourself. That's how I feel. I think you'll agree. You'll definitely agree to that.
Dr. Wood, could I ask a question in regard to what you were talking about from the very beginning, standpoint or base of reference,
yes.
I believe is what you call it, in relation to life divine and the way that it was written as a yogic demonstration. You were talking before about how difficult to determine this base of reference or the standpoint.
Well,
is and how important it is in understanding.
It's difficult to determine the base of reference that's unconscious on the part of someone else. If you know, of course, I wouldn't say that it's difficult to find the base of reference if you are a member, but of most people, yes.
Mm. Well, would you talk about his base of reference?
Well, first of all, it's a spiritual orientation in the true sense of the word. It's a looking down from above thought itself. Maybe that'll tell you what it is. And thought itself is a transcription and not a speculation. And there's a very great deal of difference between transcriptive thinking and speculative thinking. Speculative thinking I would define as the intellect operating exclusively on its own resources and hunting and imagining and positing hypotheses, which is the way we build our science. Whereas transcriptive thinking is something guided from a principle that's higher than the thinking process. That strikes down with a force of inspiration and always carries the quality of enthusiasm. And you know what the word means in its etymological sense?
God.
Yeah.
Infused.
It has that quality. And there is always in the thought a delight of that sort. Whereas in speculative thinking there can be a hard labor. Hardest kind of labor. Very difficult to get along in some of the more difficult phases of it. What a transcriptive thinking almost, you may say, thinks itself and will do easily what on a speculative basis could be a very difficult thing and perhaps even impossible.
Would you say then that what you try to do in consciousness without an object is to do what Aurobindo did, the same base of reference from this point, and you were doing the speculative?
Yeah. No, if you trace through there, you'll find at times there's a speculative type, if you're subtle enough, at other times, and more, I hope most generally, transcriptive.
That's interesting.
But the laborious element is always in the speculative, not in the transcriptive.
Well, that would be in terms of the academic that you're speaking of.
That's right. Now, you were in transcriptive thinking. Your first draft is your best. You can never improve it.
Mm-hmm.
Except perhaps change a few words. You put in synonyms instead of repeating one word more and more. You cannot correct a transcriptive work unless you are in the same state of consciousness. Without butchering it. Aurobindo says that about his own poetry. He can't correct it in an ordinary state. It's a different point. From a psychological point of view, it has to be recognized as a different function. And it always brings with it a quality of delight. You're enthusiastic, always in it.
Well, then it would be possible to take this same idea along and say that as a generality, great literature
has a touch of that transcriptive element. Anything that lives a long time and has an enormous effect, you can suspect it. Now, a person might laboriously write a poem, trying again and again, and he finally gets together words that sound all right and have a ring, but
It's without message.
Good.
And on the other hand, if it's transcriptive, you may write a poem with never having written a poem before in your life and not knowing anything about the principles of instruction.
Wouldn't Walt Whitman be a good example of somebody, of a before and after?
Yes, according to the word literary efforts of Walt Whitman before his experience, just a good experience, were a failure and they wouldn't go. And afterwards, he says the same thing about that. And if Louis Lambert, which is supposed to be the veiled biography of Balzac himself, what is described there is typical of the mystical transformation. Well, I won't say typical so much, but there's such a great variety here. I doubt that there's any such thing as two of the experiences that are duplicates of each other. But there's always something individual as well as something universal. And incidentally, when I say you cannot communicate through this concept, there is another way. Recognized by the Tibetans, according to evidence once, it's called osmosis. I use the word induction. There was a chap here, Gary, who used the word resonance. And Jung uses the word contagion, whereby something of this other consciousness can be induced in the individual. So that he has something of an inside view, and then I have collected or collected. There are no two of them precisely the same. And yet there is a certain quality of other kind of consciousness that's characteristic of all. So that, I think, is one of the best lines of evidence that another way of consciousness is, which you can get in convincing form. According to Evans Wentz, the Tibetans regard that as the highest principle of pedagogy, osmosis. And that they rate conceptual communication considerably below that.
Edmund, don't you think it's possible to be mistaken, though, about the mystical experience?
Mistaken in the interpretation?
Not that. I don't mean to be I wasn't thinking of a genuine case, but it seems to me there are many people who assure themselves that they've had these things. And
they
might be skeptical.
They might have had them, but it's only a glimpse.
My friends in William James's varieties, there's so many varieties. and he certainly thinks that some of them are on much lower levels than others.
Doubt,
yes.
Doubt.
And that person might, feel as if something really marvelous had happened. And then the question is, his criterion is it sustaining?
Sustaining,
yes.
Yes.
And that's probably
the glimpse is not enough to be sustaining.
Yes.
The real thing means that your self-reference is permanently over. What you mean by yourself is permanently over. Whereas,
well, that's what his pragmatism came in very handy. His pragmatism came in very handy.
Yeah,
that distinction.
Yeah.
Would you say there was any direct relationship between this kind of writing, which is creative, as you say, and
I'm not hearing as well as I used to.
Is there any direct relationship between this writing that you say is sort of creative, that is given perhaps from above, and a transcendental experience? I mean, is one a low forerunner of the other?
It's something that comes after experience, as far as my acquaintance with it is the case. You can have inspirations, yes, that are less than the major experience, that
do lead to superior composition and so forth, and even to doing things other than composition in any field, art, and even business ventures and so on, inventions. Orbinder says, and I think this is a valid statement, that genius is accidental yoga, and that the difference between a genius and a true yogin consists perhaps in this, and this is my own contribution now, so I won't blame him for it, if you object to it, and that is that the genius has had, first of all, imagine that you are in what Jung calls in this book, hung up by a string in a box, and right here, in this kind of consciousness. Or, as I might put it, as contained in a sort of an ellipsoid, it keeps a cell. And that restricts your consciousness to the narrow zones of our ordinary conceptions and perceptions. Now, in the case of the genius, imagine that there was a rent in that shroud that contains him, and inflows values, super mundane values, into his consciousness. That is the reason why he can do what the man of talent cannot do. He has this light from above. In the case of the yogin, a door is opened, not a rent, a door that can be opened and closed, and that there is command. The genius is driven by his diamond. The yogin is not. He can invite the diamond, or he can respond to the diamond, but he's not driven. The genius is. But there's a diamond in both cases. And you know the difference. You don't know the difference of when the diamond's on your back and when he isn't.
When I was thinking about different levels, which is in the voice, for instance, under each blossom a serpent coiled.
Yeah.
Well, this would suggest have two paths, say an upward and a downward path.
Yes, and you have the intermediate region, and in the intermediate region those serpents lie.
Mm-hmm.
There's a trouble. These young students are getting into a kind of hack yoga. Only getting into that intermediate region.
Mm-hmm. Oh, psychic region.
Yeah, there's a serpent under there, and there's poison under there. And that's the thing to close out. Because the real thing is, well, as the voice of silence says, rarely does he who reach the goal in that year where he first steps into the stream, stroke body, but usually at seven incarnations. We don't know how many incarnations we have passed through already. This might be the one where the blossoming takes place, but it is a life work, and it's not a casual doing a little meditating, a little special breathing and so forth, and you get a minor ananda and possibly a little power, which can be diversions, which can be barriers that intrigue you and keep you from going on. No stopping should there be before liberation.
Then, Sixpence, it's a subtle form of hedonism, of pleasure seeking.
Right,
yes,
to be sure. I have been in...
maybe not so subtle, even.
No, it's not too subtle. But I have three tapes on Jnana Yoga, and in those I speak of this, that the delights is not properly the goal or the objective of the practice. Becoming one with truth is the proper object. And if then delight descends upon you, receive it gratefully. But that delight is a very special delight. It gives the impression of standing on holy ground. It's not something that the ego possesses. It's something that possesses you. It's greater than you. It's not your indulgence, it's not a hedonistic past time. These students are apt to get into that from the drugs or from minor tantric practices.
Yeah. Chanting.
Yeah, I know.
Excellent.
I know there's a real danger that we have got a bunch of them coming to me now. And I'm trying to spank them into order, into a serious application. But it's a lifetime. A lot of little passion.
Well, there is something on the campus called the Kundalini Club. At least about that. I asked if they knew anything about that serpent.
They're dangerous ground. They're playing with something. They're, first of all, dealing with that particular yoga, they want to have a proficient guru watching them all the time, supervising. And I don't know that yoga from practice. I know it from theory. I've become acquainted with that. Mm-hmm. I did not do that. I use shanta. I think it's particularly dangerous to Western man. That was oriented to Indian men. Or in Tibetan, there are the tantrics involved. But I'd say be aware. Not that it couldn't be used rightly, but it lends itself to misuse. It's not guarded from turning to actually a dark evil. Not sufficiently guarded. Just because you can get results without purification. But these students have gotten a hold of it, and there are some Orientals that seem to be willing to exploit them. First of all, if they charge, I've heard, this is only in the news, I can't vouch for it, but there's one who charged $10 an admission, 5,000 students came, and picked up about $50,000. It is a basic rule that you cannot pay, ask or receive a monetary compensation for a spiritual service. Basic. So I beware of one that is seeking a monetary compensation.
That relates to Christ's statement about the man cannot serve two masters.
Yes. Mm-hmm. True. You can ask a price for a material service, not for a spiritual service.
I'm sure Socrates would be hard. The professor's receiving.
You know, why don't you refuse yourself?
Yes.
We just had a cup of coffee for a bit of break.
You caught my thought?
But you have a very good idea.
Well, I think most of your students are there for material benefit anyway. So
we can go. Well, then I think marks are different anyway between what Socrates had in mind. Universities generally have in mind.
Can you tell us about
this
Kundalini Club?
Oh, I know nothing about it except that there was a little booth there, that's all.
It's an archive.
Some of my students were
It's starting up again.
It is?
Yeah.
You tell us about it.
They have posters up saying that it's the best way to get high. And they're combining it with the sensitivities.
You're dealing with fire. You can wind up in the summer. Be aware of that, playing with that. I'd say even more dangerous than drugs.
It cuts deeper than I should think.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it does. New things with breath. too.
Drugs all they mask in one night.
Well, I'm not so sure if you do damage, you'll take more than you like to do it.
There's a lot of tendency.
Some of these are something very fine I pick up in the student, his long hair. And there's also something mixed that's very dark, it's something very dark. It's very curious. As though there's something in there like a cancer that needs to be operated on to save something that's very fine.
Don't you think that the two things go together?
Well, where the light is brightest and the shadow is not darkest, yes, this is in the painting.
Well, what do you mean exactly when you say the two things go together?
That whenever, just as you said, whenever you, this is Aurobindo's description of it, whenever there's an influx of light, there's also a rise of the dark. And that the two are intermixed, and that's
the trouble.
Part of the glory and the evil.
Yes, but most of the darkness in the students right now comes from the fact that they have a certain potential, and they don't know the direction to go in which to actualize it. All they can do right now is reject the way of, shall we say, their parents or the older generation. They know they don't want that. What they do want, they don't know. They have a certain potential, a certain sensitivity, but they don't know how to manifest it. The darkness comes because they have sort of torn down any kind of structure that their parents might want to set up, but they haven't found a structure of their own yet. The darkness certainly can and will be eliminated when they find that, when they find ways for actualizing their sensitivity in the direction that it should go. But their potential at the moment, their sensitivity is directed toward drugs or sex or something like that. And that is where in the darkness lies.
But I think that's only a small portion of it. I think it's much more generalized than that. I think that's a very accurate description of it, but in a limited way.
What do you mean?
Because I think it's a much broader than that.
What do you mean?
Well, I'd say something like, if you have a general generation of interest or an expansion of general consciousness, a desire to reach toward the light, and this is automatically turns up. And I'm speaking up in much broader terms than you are. I agree with what you said. But that's just part.
I still don't understand. In other words, I want to get... No, I think you lost my shoes right there. All right, I want to get clear about what you said. Whenever there's a general...
Well, I was thinking specifically, say, for example, Sri Aurobindo and his concept of the supramental consciousness, say, for example, that he says has been brought down to Earth. Okay. And that as a generality, saying using that, would automatically, he says, and I'm quoting him, stir up the dredges. And I think that you've said substantially the same thing.
I would agree with that, but you're not speaking in broader terms than I was speaking. What I was trying to say was this, no, that that's the case only in the beginning. In other words, any instrument is neither good nor evil in itself, but its potential for good and evil is equal. And when it comes down in its beginning stage, the potential is there. Both the light and the dark path is there. But once the potential, once the instrument starts getting used in the right direction, then there is the triumph of the light principle over the dark. And I think that's always the way it goes.
Not automatic.
Well, that depends on how you're trying to use the word automatically. Certainly it's the case that there's effort needed. But I would also say that in a certain sense, the triumph is also certain.
Yeah, guidance and discipline are essential.
Okay, fine. But that's not excluded by my use of automatic, not in the sense that I was using it.
Then that's a special sense of automatic.
Well, yes, but there's no one sense of automatic. I'm certainly not an ideal language philosopher.
I'm sorry to keep harping on Tucson. What has happened to Tucson since you have gotten there? Is what I'm thinking.
Well, oh, you mean as far as the department goes?
Yes, I mean, what
well, not much so far. Not much so far, simply because I've been there 1 year. This is my second year.
Yes.
And last year, I didn't really reveal my interest as far as that goes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I spoke to a few professors, but nothing much was said. I sort of mm-hmm. Went my way, and they went yeah. theirs. It's only this year that any kind of interaction between my ideas and their ideas is coming about, and so I really can't answer your question. It's slightly premature. And all my papers this quarter, and I'm taking 4 different courses, will be oriented toward this mystical kind of thing. I'm taking a seminar now in which we're reading Strawson's Individuals, and I'm going to give a paper in a couple of weeks on November the 3rd, in which I'm going to talk about the mystic experience and how that's related and everything. So again, I can't really answer your question until after a few more months. Because that's what's going to determine the,
what does
happen. Are the professors going to go along with that?
Well, again, I haven't interacted with them that much. There are only one or two that I talk to, and they don't really know. They haven't seen the conceptual schema. In other words, they're still very far into mysticism. They think it's they think it makes no sense whatsoever. They've never had a conceptual schema by which it's possible, laid out in front of them, by which it's possible to make sense out of the mystic experience. That's just what I'm going to do this semester. And then I'll have to see how they react to it. But I think their reaction will be favorable.
I'll be very interested.
So will I.
I took in a class last spring, Strawson and Shoemaker. And they made an interesting family. Some quite a decent one.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. We had Sidney Shoemaker down last year at Tucson for a talk, but I wasn't terrifically impressed. He's another philosopher who's...
I was just wondering what he was like.
Who's dead. It's totally... Well, he has this sort of nervous twitch and a lot of other things as well. There are too many academic philosophers who, in totally dedicating themselves to the conceptual, have sort of repressed the emotional. Because emotional, of course, philosophers now don't believe that emotional or feeling leads, plays any part in knowledge at all. Therefore, the emotions are something that are just totally outside the search for knowledge and have nothing to do with it whatsoever. So Sidney Shoemaker is like some of the philosophers at the University of Arizona who, having totally dedicated themselves to the conceptual schemata, have given up totally the emotional. That's sort of a repressed form. They're sort of cold in their classes, and this kind of emotional repression only comes out at the parties that we have. So those are psychologically interesting.
We had him first in a, no, I mean not him, but his book in a faculty seminar. Mm-hmm. And nobody made anything out of it. I rather liked it, but I did something, I wrote a paper on him. But I just got the idea that everyone thought that the book was just packed with either absurdities or inconsistencies, absurdities, or just general incoherence.
I wouldn't say agree with that. No, no. But
it was there's a lot in that that indicates that he found something about substance and that individual. Person consciousness that didn't fit into a conceptual brain. Nobody says about memory, for instance. Well, I don't want to get into this technical side. Actually, I was interested in what you were saying.
You mentioned DePaul.
Right.
In Illinois or Indiana?
I think that's the one that's in Chicago. Right, and I'm talking about DePaul with DePaul, not DePaul.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing something extraordinary up there?
Well, sort of, yes. The only reason I know is that one of the professors of at Arizona is a man by the name of Dr. Krejci, and his brother, Gerald Krejci, is the head of the department at DePaul and came down along with another professor there, was telling about some of the courses, and they were offering courses in, a lot of courses in phenomenology and studying a French philosopher by the name of Louis Lavelle, who's somewhat unusual, and they were offering, in general, just a lot of sort of unusual courses. They have much more of a phenomenological and existentialist bent than most schools do, and that's very unusual for a school in the United States. It's not so unusual for a European school, but very unusual.
Isn't that Catholic college?
I think DePaul is a Catholic college.
Yeah.
But of course, that doesn't really mean that much. Others, you certainly don't have to be Catholic to go there or anything like that.
No, but the courses, you wouldn't expect that in a Catholic school, I mean.
Oh, gosh. Lots of them, like Fordham, for instance, had lots of courses.
Phenomenology?
Yeah. Notre Dame, so on. They have lots of courses in phenomenology, existentialism, Marx. But I think they were the first, you know, who really paid attention to the European philosophers, the modern European philosophers in this country.
Who were?
The Catholic English. Well, I mean, Harvard and Princeton. And
pardon me for asking this other rather private question, but how is it at ASU?
Well, this is sort of in a fluid state, because I think they're trying to get rid of the philosophy department.
Are you saying that with any seriousness?
Well, you know, it's all mixed up with politics now. So that since we had a professor fired who was defended by the faculty and fired by the regents, you know, a desire to, in some departments, to replace people with the right political views, it may be rather difficult, I don't know. No, it isn't as bad as I pictured. In fact, I think this year, the courses, his student interest seems to be greater than it has been in some time.
Well, now, how many students do you have taking philosophy courses there? Is philosophy sort of an elective for you? In philosophy, do they allow, say, introductory courses in philosophy to count as electives toward other degrees?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. So,
in fact, so many of our, practically all of our courses have no requirements. You know, they get them at different levels, but still without prerequisites.
Would Starsky be of the new left?
Yes, oh yes.
Mm-hmm. He was.
Well, after the introductory course, how many students do you find continuing in philosophy?
Well, how many majors do we have now? I would say that.
Two.
No, no.
Oh, I was just counting Jim and
at least two. Well, no, they're right. It's a misleading figure. I would say around 27, but you know, the ones who last all the way through, is it, they can start off majoring as a freshman. The ones who graduate as majors are very few. Maybe about four or five each year. And then there's some graduate students, but no PhD. Which is all right with me. What is this?
We had the same thing in pure mathematics at Stanford. Hmm. About 30 freshmen and two of us graduated. Still.
There is, you know, generally such a striving for numbers, unfortunately.
Small classes are nice. I like being.
Yes, they will. Some of them, I have one now that has 130. That's an introductory.
Yes. You have some assistance on that, don't you?
Correct papers.
Yes.
But then the others are around 15, 20.
Well, that's good.
Do you have any classes with just one student?
Well, I have. that actually happened, but then it turns out to be just like a special reading thing, research. We always have some friends on.
I was just thinking, Dr. Wolf was talking about one class where he was the only student.
Oh, I had three of those.
Three of them were the only students.
Yes. Let's see, theory of groups, I was the only student in mathematics. And foundations of mathematics, geometry, Hilbert's ideas that were then just coming out, now they're pretty well known. Formalistic mathematics. And then critique of pure reason. Professor Putnam asked me if I wanted to have it, and he said he'd put in next year. I did. I was the only student.
Who was that who gave it?
Sabin.
Sabin?
I don't know what it is.
Oh, yes. I never knew him, but I don't know. He was at Cornell for a long time.
He was a graduate of Cornell. He was teaching at Stanford in the year. That's around 19, 10, 11, 12, in there.
The political theory was one of his specialties, wasn't it?
Not there.
Not there.
The history of philosophy, the formal logic, and what we didn't have much of a department of that recently been in. Let's see, those two, and then you put in this class, you wanted to get into something, and we were very good exercising, so I think it was we had to keep reading. And the other professor had ethics, inductive logic, and the seminar on metaphysics. That was the extent of Stanford philosophy department.
So now it has two sort of very logical sides.
Oh, yes. And they offer very few courses on the graduate level that aren't either logic or foundations of logic or metamathematics or something ridiculous like that.
Is it Goheen?
Right. Goheen is the chair.
Of both departments.
Now, what exactly do you mean? You mean graduate and undergraduate? Or
yes. I mean, he's the chairman overall.
Right.
Philosophy, yeah. Mothershed, I know. Are you at Stanford still? Is that what you mean? Or? No.
Went through part of that training with Swami. She said that she could close her eyes and see her environment around her, born close to her. Close her eyes. It's a technological test to her reality. And it was also a terrible seeing it at this, seeing on different points. And then also the direct action of the